You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
Check, check. Yeah. I love you all. Man, I'm lying. I smoke a bowl while the planet's dying. Man of iron with a flow that can span horizons. If you lame, then we beef like the vamps and lichens. It's the feeling when somebody swell your bottom lip. Fight for freedom till you got a dip, like Asada did. Waiting on reparations, that hip-hop politics. And my homie Joel is on the mix, that's a hot assist. They call me dope, cause when I spit, then you gotta fix. Since the psychedelics illegal now, then I gotta trip. What's as hot as this?
Oh, I messed up.
All right. Hey, what's going
hey!
On?
Hey, what's good, people?
I'm Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
Hurry it up.
So today we have a stacked show for you, another one. We are going to be talking about civil rights activist Asada Shakur, getting to her activism, her story, if you haven't heard it. And we're also going to talk about her connection to hip-hop and the legendary Tupac Shakur, of whom she's the godmother to.
Interestingly, very little can be found online about the relationship of Tupac to his step-aunt and godmother, Asada. But she was very much a part of just like Black revolutionary struggle in the 1960s and 1970s, as were Afeni Shakur and Mutulu Shakur, Tupac's parents. So we're going to talk about how this sort of permeated the life of Tupac and sort of set him up for the person that he was, in addition to detailing, you know, in specifics, a lot about who Asada was as this notorious figure that today is still being persecuted by the United States government.
When did you first, like, become aware of Asada Shakur in your, like, activism?
I think around the time I started studying, like, abolition, like, when I first started, like, reading the work of Angela Davis and, like, realized... You know, like, we in school get this very sanitized version of what the civil rights movement was. We don't learn about the Black Panthers. We don't learn about people like Angela Davis because they were doing crimes. Like, they were breaking people out of jail. They were robbing Brinks trucks and, like, killing police officers and, like, crazy shit that, you know, is, genuine revolutionary activity. And so around that time is when, you know, when I learned about Angela Davis and her advocacy for... political prisoners, and that's when I learned about Asada and her advocacy for Asada when Asada was imprisoned for killing a police officer.
No doubt. I think I first became aware of Asada Shakur probably with the Common song. I mean, we're gonna get into that later on in the episode, but I would have to say it was a Common song for Asada. I think I was watching a hip-hop documentary years ago, and then I saw Common make note of it. And then I was remembered, oh, yeah, that song was on that, like, Water for Chocolate album. So that was my introduction into her. I mean, like a lot of other, you know, people, I guess I kind of just assumed, oh, Asada Shakur, that's Tupac's mom, you know. So I kind of just had that idea in my head and ran with it until I found out more about who she was. So, yeah, we're going to get into that. But before we do, how's your week been?
Yo, shit's been crazy. We've had like five, I guess now six shootings here in the last week or so. Last Saturday.
What, like all police shootings or just shootings?
All just people just killing each other. Shit. We had a 20-year-old kid shot and killed last Saturday. This Saturday, there was a man who lost his life. The suspect in that shooting was 15 years old. And surprisingly, very few leaders are speaking out about it, I think, because many folks kind of take it for granted. They just assume that this is what life can be. Mm-hmm. But, like, in the last couple of days, I've been very involved in, like, reaching out to the families of the victims of the shootings. I attended the funeral of E.B. Montana, who was killed last Saturday, a 20-year-old rapper in town. And it's interesting to me, in speaking with these families, what they think the solutions are. Like, I gathered with them. I, like, helped, you know, Montana's family organize a candlelight vigil at one of our community centers on Friday. And speaking with people out there, they were like, we need to be investing in these young people. We need to be, you know, these people don't got no jobs. They ain't got no programs to be involved in. And so it's interesting, like, I think that, like, people in this discourse around policing recently, people, like, who aren't involved, who aren't impacted, who aren't, who've never lost anyone, are prescribing all the solutions, like, oh, we need, more policing. We need all these things. You go talk to the people who lose family members. That's not even something that comes to their mind. That's not even something that's a part of the conversation for them. And no one is, and I don't think anyone is asking them what their opinion is. And so it's just been like, as we also approach like budget season, you know, it was like this time last year that like the Fund the Police became a thing. Just thinking about, just trying to show up for these families that are in a lot of pain right now, and also think about like centering them and how we go about creating policy. But particularly for, you know, Montana, rest in peace, beloved young rapper here in Athens, who, you know, himself had, it came out, had some gun charges, and he had a warrant out for his arrest. And so there's, you know, in the media, like kind of painting him as like, well, he was no angel. What the fuck do you think these kids are going to do if you don't give them anything to believe in this world? And so that's just been my world for the last like week or so. But then there's crazy shit happening everywhere. I mean,
Gun violence is, I don't know for certain that it's like on any sort of record pace, but it seems like shit is getting out of control. I mean, it's not just the mass shooting statistics, but like you have, you know, individual everyday like occurrences of gun violence that doesn't even get national coverage, because not only is it just like part of the like ubiquitous cycle, but then it's like only two people died, so it's not a big story, or it's only a person here, or just somebody got injured. All the shootings that happen when people get injured that you never hear of. You remember the rapper Pop Smoke who died last year? Recently it came out that the killer of him was a 15-year-old who saw him on Instagram and tried to get his watch.
And it's not, and it's like, oh, you know, like if we don't raise, I think there's a maybe a Frederick Douglass quote, like it's easier to build strong children than repair broken men. But like, it's, I mean, we're like the children are broken.
Yeah, I mean,
like it's not even like, oh, and they grow up and become adults and start doing crazy shit. Like the kids, if you fail to invest in them, that return in a lack of investment manifests and, early.
And it's just like 15 years old. These times that we live in, everything is just accelerated as well. So, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we're gonna switch gears.
Well,
we're gonna switch gears, and we're gonna get into this whole thing with Asada Shakur and the amazing at times story of her life. We'll be back with all of that and more after the jump.
Let's talk a little bit about where Asada was from, her early life. Asada Alugbala Shakur was born Joanne Deborah Byron in Queens, New York in 1947 and grew up in Wilmington, North Carolina. She began her involvement in political activism while attending Manhattan Community College and City College of New York. And she recalled a conversation about communism with some African students as the spark of some of her revolutionary leanings. She said, I never forgot that day. We were taught at such an early age to be against communists, yet most of us don't have the faintest idea what communism is. Only a fool lets somebody else tell them who his enemy is, which I think is a good point.
Shakur spent a short period of time with the Black Panther Party, organizing protests and community education programs. She even was leading the Black Panther Party chapter in Harlem for a while, coordinating with the free breakfast program for children, free clinics, community outreach. She would eventually join the Black Liberation Army due to some disillusionment with what was going on in the Black Panther Party at the time.
She said, with a few exceptions, PE, political education classes for party members, turned out to be just the opposite. The basic problem stemmed from the fact that BPP had no systematic approach to political education. They were reading from the Red Book, but they didn't know who Harriet Tubman, Marcus Garvey, or Nat Turner were. A whole lot of them barely understood any kind of history, Black, African, or otherwise.
So that's something that I never really thought about in detail much, is like that not everybody was on the same page with everything.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the modern left, like, and like it's almost heartening to know that there were these schisms always of like people who found their organizations lacking and would move on to others, or, you know, that there were these, like even these figures and even these institutions that are memorialized so notoriously, it's just like, just mind-blowing legendary work that they did. Like, we're not perfect. And then it's almost heartening. It's like, oh, dope. You can, like, make a lasting impact in history even if you don't have your shit totally together.
Some other stuff that I kind of found about this, but I didn't really find anything that she said specifically, but apparently there was some feeling on her part that there was a lot of macho shit going on in the Black Panther Party at the time.
Yeah. So she joined the Black Liberation Army, or the BLA, which was an underground revolutionary organization from 1970 to 1981. It was kind of like the Black Panthers. It's composed of former members and also former members of another organization, the Republic of New Africa. But the group's mission statement was to take up arms for the liberation and self-determination of Black people in the United States. Mm.
Not fucking around. So they had some principles that they kind of went by. So one, that we are anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, and anti-sexist. Two, that we must of necessity strive for the abolishment of these systems and for the institution of socialistic relationships in which Black people have total and absolute control over their own destiny as a people. And then three, that in order to abolish our systems of oppression, we must utilize the science of class struggle, develop this science as it relates to our unique national condition.
In her opening statement in court in 1975, Asada would say, "The Black Liberation Army is not an organization. It goes beyond that. It is a concept, a people's movement, an idea. The concept of the BLA arose because of the political, social, and economic oppression of Black people in this country. And where there is oppression, there will be resistance. The BLA is part of that resistance movement. The Black Liberation Army stands for freedom and justice for all people."
In 1970, she was a doctor's assistant volunteering at Alcatraz Prison. At the time, there was a protest going on with some Native Americans about broken treaties and exploitation by the U.S. government. She went on to say, "I will never forget the quiet confidence as they went about their lives calmly, even though they were under the constant threat of invasion by the FBI and U.S. military. They had many of the same problems we had, and for damn sure the same enemy. They were doing as bad as we were, if not worse."
1971 was when she changed her name to Asada Olukbala Shakur. Asada is a West African name derived from the Arabic name Aisha, said to mean she who struggles, while Shakur means thankful one in Arabic. Olukbala means savior in Yoruba. She said, "The name Joanne began to irk my nerves," in her autobiography. "I had changed a lot and moved to a different beat. I didn't feel like no Joanne, or no Negro, or no American. Felt like an African woman. My mind, heart, and soul had gone back to Africa, but my name was still stranded in Europe somewhere," which then prompted her change.
Over the next few years, she would be charged with a slew of crimes, including two bank robberies in New York, the kidnap and murder of a drug dealer, an armed robbery during which she was shot, and the attempted murder of a police officer in an ambush. She was convicted of none of these, and it was all either acquittals or case dismissals.
Which is interesting because that she is, but like the memory of her being charged with these crimes outlives the reality of her acquittals or case dismissals. Like, we remember her as this like badass, like fucking crazy, you know, doing crimes.
Yeah, like outlaw.
But it's like most of the shit she was, you know, got dismissed or she was acquitted for. But anyway.
And then also, it's like the other thing too is just like, you know, if you just do a casual, casual research, if you're like, you know, wanting to know who she is, that, you know, most of what you're gonna find is about like this sort of stuff, you know what I mean? The, oh, she was involved in this and she was involved in that, and there was a shootout with this and a shootout with that, and it's like you have to dig like a lot harder to like actually find what was obviously most of her life, you know, which was activism and you know, I mean, community service and stuff like that.
Yeah, which then recalls for me, I mean, like I was talking about at the top, the recent, you know, tragedy with this kid Montana, where he, you know, was allegedly involved in a shootout like a week prior. He may have been in the car. The car may have been shooting in self-defense. In any regard, like, he had warrants out because they thought he suspected his involvement. And so the front page of the newspaper on Sunday was, you know, like, slaying rapper, had gun warrant, you know, charges, warrant out for gun charges, despite the fact that, like, it's not clear if he was involved in the crime. Mm-hmm. He may have, even if he was in the car, he may not have been the person shooting. Even if the person in the car had been shooting, it may have been self-defense. But the story that gets told is that he had warrants out for his arrest, which is very much in contrast to when we speak to his family, or like when I attended his service yesterday, people talking about how he made TikTok challenges for kids, and he, you know, would take out his neighbor's trash, and he would wave at all the city bus drivers, and all of these other things that like aren't as splashy, and so don't get picked up in like our collective, you know, and imprinted in our collective memory of who these people are.
And then when those things do come to light, they don't really have to go back and correct those headlines, because.
Nothing ever happens, and that's just like what the memory remains. The FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force was issuing nearly daily briefings on Shakur's status and allegations against her. Years later, some police officers argued that her importance in the BLA had been exaggerated by the police, with one saying that they themselves had created a myth to demonize Shakur because she was educated, young, and pretty.
The documentary evidence suggests that Shakur was targeted by the investigation named Chesrob, which was attempted to hook Asada Shakur to virtually every bank robbery or violent crime involving a black woman on the East Coast.
God damn.
Named after Shakur, Chesrob, like its predecessor, Newkill, was not limited to her.
So they were just like, just coming for her, regardless.
It's almost like a parody of what you would have, you know what I mean? Like, if somebody just told you it, it would sound like, that's like a movie, you know? But it's like, no.
That sounds like some conspiracy shit. I mean, a lot of the stuff with the FBI does, but
yeah,
it's
that
real.
That is true. Like, when in hindsight, like, a lot of that J. Edgar Hoover FBI stuff is literally the plots of movies that have been made.
So then came the infamous shootout at the New Jersey Turnpike. According to the official New Jersey Police spokesperson, Asada was on her way to a new hideout in Philadelphia and heading ultimately for Washington. And a book in the vehicle contained a list of potential BLA targets. She testified to heading to Maryland for a waitress job.
Shakur and her two associates were stopped by a state trooper for a broken taillight. Haven't we heard that before? Many, many times. And the result was a shooting that left the trooper, Werner Forster, dead, and one of the men that Asada was with, Zaid Malik Shakur, he was killed. And Asada herself was shot in both arms and her shoulder.
For The Guardian, it was in hospital that she first met Lennox Hines, the national director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. In the history of New Jersey, no woman, pretrial detainee, or prisoner has ever been treated as she was, continuously confined in a men's prison under 24-hour surveillance without adequate medical attention and exercise, he said. Shakur's defense team filed a civil suit against the state, charging that her conditions were cruel and inhumane. She was held for more than a year in solitary confinement in the basement of Middlesex County's jail for
men. Is that just
men.
Out of spite that they held her in the men's prison?
Oh, yeah. She ascribed to all her conditions a unifying theme. Oh, God, the smell. I don't care what jail I've been in, they all stink. They all have a smell unlike any smell on earth, like blood and sweat and feet and open sores, and if misery had a smell, like misery. Ugh. She was incarcerated until 1977 when she finally got to have her case in court.
For The Guardian, there is much evidence to suggest the trial wasn't fair. Transcripts from the jury selection show that at least two jurors expressed prejudice before the start of the trial. There's evidence that the officers of the defense team were being bugged, and materials relating to her case went missing from the home of the lawyer Stanley Cohen, were later found with New York City police. They weren't even trying, yo. Shit. Hines called the trial a legal lynching in a kangaroo court. The defense could not get an expert witness to testify. As Shakur noted, it was obvious I didn't have one chance in a million of receiving any kind of justice. She testified holding on to a photo of her daughter, conceived with fellow BLA member Kamayu Siddiqui, while they were both in jail and born in 1974. The jury reached a verdict after 24 hours. She was found guilty on all 7 counts. As Hines explained, under New Jersey law, if a person's presence at the scene of a crime can be construed as aiding or abetting the crime, that person can be convicted of the substantive crime itself. Shakur was handed a mandatory life sentence.
So while in prison, Shakur was introduced to liberation theology, which is a synthesis of Christian theology and socioeconomic analyses that emphasizes social concern for the poor and political liberation for oppressed peoples.
Actual, like, Jesus type stuff?
Yeah, so like Jesus, but like Jesus, I would argue. It was like, yo, homie was hanging out with the homeless and prostitutes and was like murdered by the state. And like, what does this mean for us today in terms of how we enact, you know, a good life as a Christian to upend and disrupt oppression of various kinds?
Here's something interesting I found on Wikipedia. Shakur was identified as a political prisoner as early as October 8th, 1973. By Angela Davis. And in April 3rd, 1977, the New York Times advertisement purchased by the Easter Coalition of Human Rights. An international panel of 7 jurists was invited by Hines to tour a number of U.S. prisons and concluded in a report filed with the United Nations Commission for Human Rights that the conditions of her solitary confinement were totally unbefitting of any prisoner. Their investigation, which focused on alleged human rights abuses of political prisoners, cited Shakur as one of the worst cases of such abuses.
So it's interesting that her particular predicament then led to this larger indictment of the prison system and the practice of solitary confinement in the United States, which is totally abhorrent, if you ask me. But, so, in 1979, 3 members of the BLA walked into the Clinton Correctional Facility for Women with guns and a stick of dynamite, took 2 guards hostage, commandeered 2 vans, and broke Asada out of prison in what I would call a pretty bold escape. The guards, to be clear, were left in the parking lot, no one was injured, but they just broke her ass out. They were like, y'all ain't keeping my girl in solitary.
Pretty daring escape. You know what? Do you think that, like, with this new surgence of, like, black cinema, do you think we're going to get, like, a definitive Asada Shakur movie?
Do we not have one yet?
I don't think we do. I can't recall one. At least nothing that's like, popping to mind that's, like, worth noting right now. I can't really think of one. But just you know, getting to this part of the story is like, oh, yeah, no, I need to see this filmed. Like, what was the stick of dynamite for? What do we...
Apparently there was a documentary, Asada, aka Joanne Chesimard, that came out in 2009. I don't know a lot about it, but I think more of what we're talking about in the line of like,
yeah, Jesus, exactly,
Black Messiah, like, Denzel casting
Malcolm X, you know,
Malcolm X, like a block, like a
cinematic
like a
movie,
Hollywood,
yeah,
Hollywood movie,
you know, some. With
a little bit of
fiction and a little bit of historical, you know, one of those blurring the line sort of, you know. So she was at large fugitive for years after that. In New York, 3 days after her escape, more than 5,000 demonstrators organized by the National Black Human Rights Coalition carried signs with her name on the slogan. At that rally, a statement from Shakur was circulating, condemning the U.S. prison conditions and calling for an independent new African state.
She was granted political asylum in Cuba in 1994 and has been living in exile there ever since. Over the decades, there have been 4 or 5 attempts to try to extradite her back to the United States, with the last being in June 2017, when President Donald Trump gave a speech canceling the Cuban thaw policies of his predecessor Barack Obama. A condition of making a new deal between the United States and Cuba was the release of political prisoners and the return of fugitives from justice. Trump specifically called for the return of cop killer Joanne Chesimard.
So I remember when that all went down, and that's cool because it kind of lets us transition into our music discussion a little bit. But I remember when that all went down, there was like a brief period of time where a bunch of outlets were like posting it as Trump goes after Tupac's mother. And that's all they were saying.
People don't even like.
Yeah, they weren't even
right.
Like really like digging at it like that. I guess they were just hearing Shakur, and then I guess seeing that there was a connection between the two, and there was like a slew of headlines that was like Trump going after Tupac's mother. I remember waking up that day and looking on Twitter, and it's like, wait, what? Huh?
But now let's transition to talking a little bit about Tupac and the revolutionary, just like bedrock of who he became that echoes very much a lot of what we have learned about Asada to this point. So Asada was Tupac's step-aunt and godmother. Not much is known publicly about their relationship. And though they were not related by blood, much of her revolutionary activity and stance can commonly be found in the Shakur family bloodline.
Tupac's birth mother, Finney, was also an active member in the Black Panther Party. She wrote the Black Panther Party newsletter, Panther Post, and led a successful campaign that tricked the FBI to believe the party was fading. In April 1969, she and a number of other Black Panthers were arrested and charged with several counts of conspiracy to bomb police stations and other public places in New York. Sure, those were real charges. When the trial came, a Finney who was pregnant with Tupac at the time, who had not attended law school, and who was facing down a 300-year prison sentence, chose to represent herself in court. 1 month before giving birth to Pac, she was acquitted of all charges. Pac was very close to his mother, who sometimes also served as his publicist, and he famously dedicated his song, Dear Mama, to her. A Finney and her children moved to Baltimore, Maryland, 1984. During his time at the Baltimore School for the Arts in the late 80s, Tupac began attending meetings in the Baltimore branch of the Young Communist League USA, which he had since renamed itself the Tupac Shakur Club in his honor. Unfortunately, we could find little about his time with the Young Communist League in the research, but I think the influence as well as his time with the Black Panther could be heard in his anti-imperialist class-conscious lyrics.
So Afeni's first husband, Lumumba, was the leader of the Black Panthers in Harlem and married Afeni in 1968. Their marriage unraveled after the revelation came forth that Lumumba was not Tupac's biological father. In the aftermath, Afeni married Mutula Shakur, Lumumba's adopted stepbrother. Mutula was politically active with the Revolutionary Action Movement, a U.S.-based revolutionary black nationalist group that applied the philosophy of Maoism to conditions of black people in the United States. He later joined the Republic of New Africa that we referenced earlier, which is a black nationalist and separatist group that sought reparations, as well as to establish an independent black majority nation in the southern United States. Mutula shared a close bond with Pac, and together they wrote the famous Code of Thug Life, a set of rules discouraging unprovoked violence between gangs. Mutula is currently serving a 60-year prison sentence for his involvement in a 1981 robbery of a Brinks armored truck, in which Mutula, several other members of the Black Liberation Army, in coalition with four members of the radical left organization of the Weather Underground, stole $1.6 million, killing a guard and two police officers in the act. Interesting fun fact, another conspirator in the robbery, Kathy Boudin, is mother of Chessa Boudin, who was in 2019 elected the district attorney of San Francisco.
Damn, it's a fucking small world when you're creating
small
a revolution.
Small world when you're robbing Brinks trucks.
Damn, yeah, that's a crazy story.
Yeah, I mean, and so I think it speaks to the fact that, like, under, like, you know, neoliberal and neoconservative policies of the, you know, 70s and 80s, a lot of people, you know, you either became a revolutionary or you became a criminal, or the line between
them was kind
of
blurred.
Or, you know, you became a thug, or the line between them was very blurred. Like, what was the difference between being a revolutionary and being a thug if this is, like, if undermining the state is what this looks like?
I mean,
you know, if this is, you know, that they're engaging in very similar activities, arguably to different ends. When on the one end, if you're like, you know, thug life for the accumulation of capital, for, you know, getting yourself out of poverty, for like repping your set, versus like this other group of folks that were shooting police officers and crazy shit like that, but with the aims of like establishing a separatist black state and like things. And so I think in the larger conversation that we have on the show about the relationship between hip hop and politics, like, I think studying the lives of Afeni and Mutulu and Asada show us like the many ways that the activity of both hip hop and revolution overlap in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, and I think that it's also good just in a historical context to not whitewash events or eras and things like that. It's like the civil rights movement as we know it to be wasn't like every day was the I Have a Dream speech. You know what I'm saying? It's like
there's a lot of this in the trenches shit.
It involved like thousands of people, like with, you know, hundreds of individual stories of how people were like contributing to that whole fight. And not all of it was pretty, you know what I'm saying? Like, obviously. And that's another theme that I think we're gonna continue to explore. But let's get into like the direct music discussion. Oh, you know, just talking about that whole thing with Tupac. Fun fact about me, my godmother is Mae Jemison, who was the first black woman in space. The more you know.
Was she also on Star Trek?
Yeah, she was also the first real life astronaut on Star Trek. I think that's the trivia.
I love that my response, like, oh, it's not impressive enough to me that she went to motherfucking space. I'm like, but was she on Star Trek, though?
All right, so.
I don't have a cool godmother story, I'm sorry. But.
Well, you have so many cool stories. I just got that one.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's pretty dope. But yeah, let's turn to look at some of Asada's impact on hip-hop music, as well as the revolutionary ideologies that she, Afeni, and others shared. Trickled into the music of Tupac
as well. So the first song that we're going to talk about is the 2000, I guess the only way to describe it as an epic, it's a 6 minute long epic song by Common called Song for Asada. It's off of his album Like Water for Chocolate, produced by James Posner.
Let's check that out real quick.
Super, they asked her, put the mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced till things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed. She got chills.
Common's words about it. He said, it stemmed from me just reading her autobiography. I read the book 2 or 3 times. I went down to Cuba. I had to feel every element I could to get in to, so I could write that story.
Yeah, he talks about making this move until it's freedom for all those who are oppressed, all those in struggle. And then gets into, like, in very, very graphic detail, you know, the gunshots firing, laying in a puddle of blood and blood bubbling from her chest, and, you know, the feel of, like, the gunshot, like, the open wound of the gunshot, you know, before she was later questioned by the police. Like, it's very, you know, it's, like, very viscerally first person.
Vivid. Like, the thing that...
It's vivid. It's so vivid.
The first thing that stands out to me is obviously like the length of it, because you know, you don't really see too many 6 minute long rap songs, even when it's about something serious, you know. And we,
I mean, there's decades and decades to discuss with
exactly.
in regard. So
and we
I mean,
were just talking about how, oh, that story is so wild that somebody should make a movie of it, you know, or is there a movie of it? And this is kind of the hip hop version of that, you know. It's a very vivid, very detailed, and visually so recounting of the story that we just told you guys all in the course of this episode. It's kind of like I did this TED Talk thing not too long ago, and it was like about how when you rap lyrics seep in more and information when presented as rap can, you know, be retained easier and be ingrained in the mind more. And I think the song kind of, you know, proves that, because like this is like a summary of our whole episode just now in the 6 minutes, but it's got like a dope beat to it.
Yeah, y'all should have listened to this. Y'all should have just gone listen to Song for Asada, to be completely honest. Our apologies for wasting your time.
So what you got next?
So, you know, she gets a shout out on Public Enemy's Rebel Without a Pause, but I think that turning to look at some of the influence of Black Panther and other Black radical ideology in the music of Tupac is really interesting, particularly, if you look at Keep Your Head Up, you know, which we all know, but then sort of looking at it through the lens of the influence of strong black female leaders in Tupac's life, it then sort of gives more context to, like, when he says, some say the black of the bear is the sweet of the juice, some say the dark of the flesh, the deep of the roots. I gave a holler to my sisters on welfare. Tupac cares. If don't nobody else care, you know, encouraging women to dry your eyes, never let up, keep your head up, and not accept the disrespect of black men in our community who may not have seen, like, the, who may not have been exposed to, like, the power of, like, you know, really strong black leaders in the way that he was in his young life.
I think it's one of those interesting things about Tupac that, unfortunately, just like a lot of things in history, gets lost, because when people pass away, it's like a lot of the imagery of him that people, that sticks with people, is like the wild, like, thug dude getting in trouble, that people don't realize that Tupac is a guy that was raised by women that, like, cared very much about his sister and was, like, really, you know, for all the contradictions that rappers have, I don't think that there was, like, any, like, I mean, I guess there's definitely misogynistic Tupac lyrics, but not, like, dehumanizing, like, misogynistic Tupac lyrics. Does that make sense?
I mean, we can definitely find worse examples, yes. We can definitely find, like, worse examples.
Yeah, exactly, you know, like...
So, White Man's World was a... came out September 26, 1996. It's Outlaws member E.D.I. Mean provided some background information on the song. So it's a personal record. It's like an open letter to his mother and his sister. It's like he's writing from jail and just apologizing for a lot of shit. At 25, we're all trying to grow up and change, figure shit out. A lot of people don't remember that he was only 25 at the time. He was still a kid. This is sort of like a letter to his family of, like, yo, apologize for fucking up. But in it, it's got an interesting couple of lines. About, like, learning the lessons of never falling for riches, apologizing to his true sisters, far from bitches, that they helped me raise my black nation, reparations are due, and that it's so true, caught up in this world, I took advantage of you, but tell them babies how I love them, precious boys and girls, born black in this white man's world. So there's, like, hinting at, like, the ways that, pinned under the boot of, like, racial capitalism, like, we get pitted against each other, like, you know, black men versus black women, black men versus black men, lower class whites versus lower class blacks, and we're falling for the riches, we're all valuable, and really, if we got our fair share, you know, we could, like, rise up and not deal with this shit.
It was one of those posts. Songs After He Died is one of the Machiavelli songs. I always wonder, because the thing with, like, a lot of those songs to me that's always stuck out is, like, none of that stuff feels like rushed. It's usually, like, a lot of it is the type of songs that you have to think about, you know what I'm saying? Like, as far as, like, that you would imagine somebody who's writing it has to think about. It doesn't feel like, oh, this is just some bullshit that I'm doing in the studio. It's, like, really still, like, politically charged or very emotional songs and stuff like that that he did at some point when he was still alive by, like, the tens. He just did, like, albums and albums worth of songs like these that are hidden gems throughout, because I had never even, like, thought about this shit. I've heard this album a couple times back in the day, but I've never even recalled this song. And this is, like, kind of following on the same themes that he was going when he was making Dear Mama. It's, like, that same sort of uplifting, like, you know, like, uplifting black women in the community, even though they're not getting their proper due respect from everybody else, sort of vibe that song had to it.
And then our last, it's actually not a song, it's a poem. I didn't know that Tupac released a book of poetry that poems that he wrote between 1989 and 1991, published by, it was like through MTV Books. I don't know, MTV printed.
I didn't know about that. I mean, I remember that. I remember that book, The Rose That Grew From Concrete, but I didn't know it was published by MTV Books.
And so I guess Mos Def did an interpretation of a Tupac poem that, in the original, evokes Black Panther Party for Self-Defense ethos.
Can you see the pride in the panther as she nurtures her young all alone?
When they talk about, can you see the pride in the Black Panther as he grows in splendor and grace, toppling obstacles placed in the way of the progression of his race.
Fresh. I don't think I ever heard that shit before. Again, like, I knew about this book. I didn't know that they put out a whole album where different artists were doing interpretations of it, though. But that's something that I've kind of always wanted them to, just rappers to start doing in general, is like, I think cats should not be afraid to do covers in hip-hop the way they do in other forms of music. Because, you know, like, a rock band can be like, hey, we want to give a shout-out to Smashing Pumpkins and then do their interpretation of a Smashing Pumpkins song. But how come, you know, like, how come you can't get, like, Migos doing their version of a Ludacris song or some shit like that? Like, I would want to see that. I would want to see one of these new rappers, like, give a shout-out to DMX and do their version of Rough Riders Anthem or something like that. So this is fresh. I got to check this out.
All right. That's dope. Learn something new today. But yeah, that's all
we
got for this week.
So we are going to be back with you next week. What are we going to do next week? Do we know yet? I don't know. It's going to be a mystery. But whatever it is, it's going to be dope. But you know how we always close it off. We got to get that beat so that we can spit some rhymes. Joel, my good man, can we get a instrumental?
Waiting on reparations. Waiting on reparations. Got it.
They thought that marketing me would be that simple. Wanted X single, necessary to get linked to be a sex symbol. I said, I get it. Sexually, I'm delectable, but intellectually, I'm like cheddar cheese for cholesterol. Hella, hella elevated. You LOL and my eloquence. Well, I bet you 7 cents if you're jealous later. I bet you 37 cents. Attorney feminist by the time that we well acquainted. Femininity has plenty enemies from the center of Venice to the western end of Tennessee. If you looking for honey loving tenderly in the sheets, yes again, motherfucker, I'm frenzied and indiscreet.
Not a lot of MCs that try to rock to this. I say I'm dope, you perceive that as confidence. I got green plant seeds like a botanist, and I got speed, you gon' need that Robotnik. The rose from concrete, I do it like Tupacalypse, and eat these rappers like they chocolate chip. I could not resist. Hit the pressure points until you call me Spock and shit. Waiting on reparations, certified to be rocking it. Yeah, yeah, it's like dope, 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 dope. Hey, my name's Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
See you next week.
See you next week.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.